It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, Wisconsin is getting a lot of the 2016 spotlight. We'll talk about the news that both major political parties will be holding presidential debates here in the state. First, the PGA Tour Championship takes place in Kohler, Wisconsin this week. Area residents and businesses are hoping for an economic boost. Golfers and fans from around the world are descending on northeastern Wisconsin for the event. They'll need places to eat, sleep, and shop while they're there. Wisconsin might seem like a surprising destination for golf enthusiasts because of our short playing season, but the sport actually plays a pretty big part in the state's economy. We're joined now by Kevin Quinn, Dean of the Donald J. Schneider School of Business and Economics at St. Norbert College. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I know this might be hard to measure accurately, but ballpark, what kind of impact does an event like this PGA Tour have on a community like the Kohler area?
Well, you hit the nail on the head when you say that it's hard to calculate it. Usually these studies are done by people that have a vested interest in making the number look big. The most reliable numbers so far suggest between $75 and $100 million for the state. I would guess that's probably too big by half, but it's still a pretty substantial number. And if you just look at the Sheboygan County and around Kohler there, all 1,800 of their hotel rooms were booked long ago. So it definitely has an impact on that area. It doesn't have impact on, a lot of nightlife, because golfers get up early and they pretty much have dinner and go home. But it definitely is bringing in money into that area that wouldn't have otherwise been there.
And do we know, obviously the hotel industry is one that's probably going to do pretty well by this. What other kinds of businesses might rake in some cash on an event like this?
Well, definitely restaurants and the basic hospitality industries do so, gas stations, anything that would be benefited by just a ginormous influx of people. I mean, something like 200,000 people are supposed to be there. And, in fact, this is supposed to be the highest grossing PGA championship ever, which is partly a reflection of how good a job the folks at Whistling Straits do and the Kohler people do, but it's also a reflection of the fact that the economy is finally starting to get better.
Now, when we talk sports and economics, a lot of times we're talking about building new, basketball stadiums, how much public investment goes into something like that. So on the one hand, you're talking about how much money it brings in. It seems like a golf course is going to take in less public investment, less public risk than something like a major league sports arena.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. It wasn't all that long ago that sports facilities were all privately financed, and it's only, I'd say, in the last 50 or so years that that somebody got wise and figured out that, wow, if we can credibly threaten to move a team, we can extract some resources from the local community. Well, anybody can build a golf course, and so these are definitely primarily private ventures. So in a sense, unlike the Bucks case where you have to subtract off the public investment, there's relatively little public investment that has to go in there. There's some. I mean, there's some additional, highway stuff they have to do and maybe a little security. But for the most part, this is mostly private money that's generating all kinds of benefits for the state.
Now, I live here in Wisconsin. If you asked me a week ago, I would not have guessed that Wisconsin was a big golf state, and I would have been wrong. We have, it turns out, a disproportionate, when you look at states, investment, a number of golf courses, people who play the game. Why is Wisconsin, any idea, such a big golf state?
Well, it's really quite surprising that that's the case. There's something like 500 golf courses here, or one golf course for every 11,000 people. And I noticed they're all there on Sunday afternoons. but a lot of this has to do with the vision of one guy, Herb Kohler, quite honestly, in terms of raising the profile for Wisconsin as a golf destination. But it's a little more than that. I mean, despite the fact that we only have a seven-month season here, maybe 6 months is more realistic, this is definitely a travel and tourism state. It's a leisure state. Real estate is relatively inexpensive in a lot of parts of the state, and there, as a result of that, it's easier to build golf courses, and it's a little bit cheaper. And the other thing is, I just think that in Wisconsin, golf is a little more democratized than you would see in some other big cities. I mean, if you go out on a Thursday night and you see the local golf leagues, you know, the company golf leagues, it doesn't really look a lot different than the bowling leagues in terms of who's there. If you were to do that in the Chicago or Philly area, you would find it's a pretty well-heeled crowd up there. And so I think that's also part of the reason why. A lot of people hear golf.
And you mentioned the weather issue. People will go to Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra, in the middle of December for a game. You can't do that so much for golf. It would be a very different game, I imagine. So we can sustain this business even without those 5-6 months where it's too cold, the inclement weather, to play golf?
Yeah, the folks that live in Wisconsin are willing to play golf in conditions that people who live elsewhere in the country would never consider doing so. I was fortunate enough to be in Florida playing golf this last January. It was in the 50s, and there was no one on the courses because it was impossible to play golf when it was that cold. So that's definitely not something that we see here. Maybe we're a hardier type.
Talking to Kevin Quinn from St. Norbert College about the economic impact of this PGA Tour Championship happening here in Wisconsin. So, Kevin, on the one hand, we've got this one big windfall-type event, this PGA Tour this week. And on the other hand, there's these golf courses that are open as much of the year as they can be. Long-term, which of them is a bigger deal for the state's economy?
Oh, without any question, it's not the one-time event. It's the ongoing, regular business of it. You know, there are going to be 1,000 temporary workers that are going to be hired for this event. I think there are 8 full-time staffers or something like that Kohler has, 3,000 volunteers. Compare that to the fact that, you know, we have a Wisconsin, you know, golf economy that's somewhere between $1 and $1.5 billion. So there's a big difference there. I mean, that's a regular business that happens here. However, that said, I think that the spate of major tournaments, and remember, this thing's going to get 28 hours of television coverage. It reminds people that this is a golf course state. It gives exposure to Sheboygan. I mean, think back 10 or 15 years ago. If they would have said Sheboygan on national television, you know, people would laugh at the funny name.
It was
now
a punchline.
Now you say Sheboygan,
name, yeah.
And people go, yep. That's a golf place, and there's beautiful views. I mean, you know, the cameras and the HD are going to be showing the lake and the beauty that is Whistling Straits. So these tournaments really buttress the fact that Wisconsin is a great golf destination, but it's really, truly the everyday stuff that swamps the one-time event stuff in terms of economic impact.
But this is massive free marketing for that day-to-day stuff, you're saying.
Oh, yeah. If you're the travel and tourism person for Sheboygan County, you know, once you're able to sleep after this is over, I mean, you reap benefits for a long, long time. And, you know, the Ryder Cup, which is perhaps even a bigger deal than the PGA Championship, that's just right around the corner. That's 2020. So as soon as they're done with this, they're going to have to start ramping up for that.
Is it a worry for you as a sometime golfer, as I understand it, that, hey, this is going to be too popular? It's going to be hard to get a tee time in this state for the locals?
Well, for the last, I don't know, 10 or so years, and certainly accentuated by the economic downturn, the state of the golf industry has not been very good. You know, the TV ratings, I think, have been off, although the demographic that they pull in is unbelievable. I think something like the, you know, a third of the people who watch golf on television have household incomes of over $100,000, which is an incredible, you know, demographic. Mm-hmm. But we're starting to see signs that there's a bit of an upturn. The number of rounds played per year last year was up for the first time in a long time. So right now, if I had to say anything, there are probably more golf courses than the demand would support, but there are signs of life.
And
so I'm not too worried about getting a tee time.
We've got excess capacity if there is higher demand.
Yeah, I mean, and especially here in Wisconsin, I mean, we have so many great courses. I think 7 of the top 100 public courses in the country are here in Wisconsin. And even the courses that aren't in the top 100, they're great ones. And, you know, for kids who are looking to just get out and knock a ball around, you don't have to spend, you know, even as much money to take your kids out to play golf as you would for a ticket to Lambeau Field. I mean, there are lots of very inexpensive executive courses, et cetera. So here there's a very good golf ecosystem, and I'm sure they'd like to see more people on the courses, but for now it's a heyday for those who like to golf.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was economist Kevin Quinn from St. Norbert College talking about golf's economic impact on the state as the PGA Championship comes to Whistling Straits this week. Republicans will hold a debate here in the fall. Democrats planning to hold one in February or March. Party leaders haven't announced exact locations yet. Our next guest says Wisconsin is getting more of the spotlight in the 2016 election than in previous years. Keith Knutson joins us now. He's a professor of history at Viterbo University. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Well, were you surprised to learn that Wisconsin is going to host a debate for both parties here?
I think that is surprising for us in Wisconsin. We've been getting a lot of campaign visits, but primary presidential debates are something new for us and very exciting.
Now, we are a swing state in presidential elections, usually going Democratic, but by a close margin. Do you think that's part of the reason that both parties want to have a presence here?
I think that's very much part of the reason. 2000 was a very close race, and 2004 as well. And so we're a purple state, and I think the Republican Electoral College map is looking to pick up Wisconsin, which I think the Republicans very much need to do.
We are not widely viewed as a key primary state. We're not generally early on that calendar. But given the big field on the Republican side, maybe an extended challenge of Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, do you think we might still be at play when primary votes come to town?
With as many Republican candidates as we're looking in the field, I think there's a real possibility. It's been a long time since 1960 when JFK and Hubert Humphrey battled it out in Wisconsin in the springtime. So it's good for our state, and it's an indication that on the Republican side, Wisconsin personalities are important leaders in that party.
Right. We've gotten a big platform here in Wisconsin, especially, as you say, the Republican Party. Governor Walker running for president, Paul Ryan for vice president. Reince Priebus, the head now of the National Republican Party, had that job here in Wisconsin. Is that part of why you think we're getting this this kind of love?
Well, I'm not privy to their negotiations, but I think we can pretty safely presume that these top-tier Republican Party leaders are from Wisconsin, are advocating for our state to be part of the process. And of course, Governor Walker has gotten a lot of press with his policies, and to a great extent, the consternation in reaction to something like Act 10. And we were in the news quite a bit nationally as that policy was implemented. So I think the policies of Governor Walker, the influence of our top party officials, and the fact that we are potentially a swing state, although it has been several decades since the Republicans have managed to carry Wisconsin in a presidential election, all those factors come into play.
Talking to Keith Knutson from Viterbo University about the news, and now that both major political parties will hold presidential debates here in Wisconsin, and that's somewhere here in Wisconsin. Keith, what do you think goes into the decision of where in Wisconsin you hold your party's debate?
Well, it's interesting. The Republicans held their debate, their first debate in Cleveland, Ohio. One might have chosen other cities in that state. I think we generally presume that it's going to be large population concentrated areas. But as I told the La Crosse Tribune the other day, if either one of the parties really wants to get into the heartland, the city I'm talking from, La Crosse, would be a good one. But the parties are going to look at the demographic base of the state. Where can they get the best effect? So what city are they going to choose? And, of course, what are the facilities that the city offers to put on the venue?
Right. So Madison and Milwaukee, at least the cities themselves, generally viewed as safe Democratic areas. But if you look at maybe a place like Green Bay and work in the Fox cities there in more swingy type districts historically, people talk about your part of the state, Western Wisconsin, as you get covered across the border in the Minneapolis-St. Paul media area. Do those kind of things weigh in as maybe reasons not to go to the two biggest cities?
Well, I think that is indeed a possibility. Minnesota generally doesn't look too profitable for the Republicans this coming election season, although they recently held their national convention in Minneapolis. I think that where will they find the greatest influence? And I don't think the media market is necessarily the determining factor anymore, because the media outreach, the capacity to reach a larger media audience, may not depend upon the particular city that the event would be held in.
Yeah, as we saw with that Cleveland debate, it got a lot of attention nationwide, in large part, apparently, because Donald Trump was present. Is this more interesting for Wisconsin and the world if Trump is still in the election by the time this this debate comes here?
Well, apparently, Donald Trump does make it interesting. I guess we're to some extent talking reality TV, and with 24 million viewers tuning into that first debate, that's good for the other candidates to get exposure. But the media conversation since the debate has pretty much been focused on Donald Trump, and of course Wisconsin's governor discovered that he lost a few percentage points in the Iowa public opinion polling after that debate, and so Governor Walker might want to try to pick it up a little bit in the next debate.
Well, let's look a bit at the presidential voting history of Wisconsin. Obviously, in the last couple of decades, we're a state that's willing to elect Republicans or Democrats to the U.S. Senate, to the governor's office. How far back, though, do we have to go to find the state voting Republican in that presidential race?
1984 with Ronald Reagan, the last year Republicans carried our state. I don't know the voter turnout for that year, but I do know in the last presidential election, 2012, 70% of our 4.4 million eligible voters turned out. So in a close race with a high voter turnout rate, Wisconsin could be a key state to carry.
And why is it, do you think, that Wisconsin has gone so consistently, as you say, since 1984 for Democrats in that presidential race, but is willing to split things up in the other big statewide races?
Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Walker has won elections when the voter turnout has been in the mid 50% range. And a lot of those voters who aren't showing up in the midterm elections, but getting there in the presidential elections, trend to vote for the Democratic Party. So a lot of this is a matter of when is the election held and who's turning out to vote, and then what is the voter turnout in that particular election.
Some people made something of the fact that Ohio Governor Kasich had a home field advantage in that Cleveland debate. Not clear how much that helped him, if at all. Would Governor Walker benefit from having that home field advantage in a Wisconsin debate?
I think that would benefit Governor Walker. I think plays psychologically on the candidate itself, himself in this case, it also then provides a venue by which that person probably feels more confident. And I saw some positive reactions to Governor Kasich in Cleveland. It's always nice to play to your home audience, I think.
And speaking of that home audience, supposing Governor Walker is the standard bearer for the Republicans next year, does that give them a better chance of finally carrying Wisconsin again in a presidential race?
Well, that certainly is Governor Walker's argument. I do think that the voter turnout and the approval ratings of Governor Walker make that somewhat questionable, but certainly as the native son candidate, it would give the Republicans probably as good a shot as they've had since, let's say, 2000, when Al Gore, I think, led George W. Bush by about 15,000 votes or something like that.
And turning to the Democratic side, there's some thought that this is Hillary Clinton's election to lose. She's the likely contender. Do you see the kind of interest on the Democratic debate or in the Democratic debate that we've seen in Republican debates so far?
Well, the Democrats have purposely limited the number of their debates, perhaps some influence from the idea that an acknowledged front runner from the get-go, unlike the Republicans, where the field has been pretty wide open. So the Democrats are going to begin their debate season October 13th in Nevada. And as you say, they'll come to Wisconsin in March. By the way, the media outlet presenting that debate is going to be PBS. I think it's quite appropriate that Wisconsin gets PBS to present the debate. It should be an informative and well-run debate. The Republicans are having twice as many debates, cutting it down from their last cycle 3 years ago now, starting as early as May of 2011. The debate scene is an opportunity to get the party loyalists enthused, but also, of course, all of this is designed to begin the process of expanding their appeal when the general election season comes along. But first, these candidates have to get the nomination. Sometimes there are cross purposes going on there.
Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Keith Knutson, professor of history at Viterbo University, with us to talk about the news that both major political parties in the U.S. will hold presidential debates here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 2016 U.S. Senate race between Senator Ron Johnson and former Senator Russ Feingold is heating up. Today, the National Journal ranked Johnson's seat the second most likely in the country to change parties in the coming election. That's down from the publication's spring rankings when it's listed the seat as the most likely to switch. Criticism of both politicians has been quick to come in recent months. Feingold has called on Johnson to sign a pledge not to accept advertising from outside political groups, which he hasn't done so far. Johnson's camp has criticized Feingold for spending the large majority of his political action committee's funds on fundraising and salaries, as well as increasingly accepting donations from outside of Wisconsin in spite of a previous pledge. Most recently, Democrats have filed a complaint against Johnson for using his Senate page to attack Feingold in possible violation of ethics rules. Here with us to break down the latest in the Senate race is Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
So why are analysts picking this seat as one of the likeliest to change parties in 2016?
Well, it's Ron Johnson is a first-term senator. He was elected in that 2010 wave of, you know, sort of anti-health care, anti-Obama sentiment. And some of the other folks who are looking to run for re-election this time around are also coming out of that 2010 wave. And so you see a different electorate also in a presidential year than you do in a non-presidential year, as your most recent guest was talking about as well.
And so this has maybe more to do with voting trends and timing than the difference between the two candidates in a way?
Well, I mean, I think that there are probably vulnerabilities on both sides with regard to both Senator Johnson and former Senator Feingold. But I do think that the difference between the presidential election turnout in Wisconsin and the 2010 sort of turnout was substantial in terms of the demographics and the number of people voting, the percentages and so forth.
Well, you mentioned vulnerabilities for both candidates. Let's go into those. Let's start with the current incumbent, Senator Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, Senator Johnson has had a somewhat lower profile among sort of first-term senators. I mean, again, when you're sort of comparing Senator Johnson to somebody like Ted Cruz, who's also a first-term senator, you see a pretty distinct difference, obviously, in terms of profiles, high or low profile. But, you know, the first-term senators tend to be more vulnerable in general. And the question is also what are they doing in terms of campaigning in their state? What have they brought home to their state during that first 6 years that they've been in the Senate? How has that term gone? You know, what have they done in terms of campaigning back at home? How familiar are people with them? And I think that's unfortunately for Senator Johnson, one of the difficulties that he's facing is that some of the recent polls have shown that people are not that familiar with him.
And then on Senator Feingold's side, what kind of vulnerabilities are there?
Well, Senator Feingold obviously is very well known for the McCain-Feingold legislation, which was a campaign finance reform legislation that he very high-profilely co-sponsored with Senator John McCain with regard to trying to limit a lot of the sort of money in politics that he originally, when he first ran for Senate, says is one of the difficulties with regard to politics in the United States, and he's still talking about that. But he's also been critiqued recently with regard to one of the PACs that he established after he was defeated by Senator Johnson, and what that money has been going towards, as well as potentially taking or soliciting money or raising funds from outside of Wisconsin.
Now, I'm billing this so far as a Feingold-Johnson rematch. It's still early. There could be other people in the primary on either side. But given the two, there's an incumbent here, a former incumbent, and a big name in Wisconsin politics on the other side. Do you think it's likely that we'll see significant candidates with a chance to make a primary race of it?
I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out. But, you know, it's usually more difficult these days in terms of mounting a primary campaign in general. But you've seen some of them that have been successful, more successful on the Republican side in the last couple of election cycles. But where Ron Johnson sits on the sort of political spectrum, I don't expect that we would see somebody sort of, you know, primarying him, as the term has now become a verb, from the right. He was elected to some degree as a kind of Tea Party candidate, and so I don't know that you would see somebody sort of taking him on in the primary. In terms of Feingold, there's obviously been some movement to try to recruit Russ Feingold to run for office again. So I don't know, again, that there would be a movement within the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, just like I'm not anticipating one in the Republican Party in Wisconsin, to primary either of these candidates.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University about Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race 2016, a very likely rematch. Ron Johnson, the current incumbent, his predecessor, who he beat 5 years ago now, Russ Feingold, challenging him from the Democratic side. Well, let's get into the campaign finance issues, because that's been a lot of the back and forth so far. Shortly after Russ Feingold said he was entering the race, he asked Ron Johnson to agree to a pledge that neither of them would accept funds of help, advertising support from third-party political groups, wanted him to sign on to a pledge that we saw in a Massachusetts Senate race, a similar pledge, having penalties if that kind of third-party advertising happens. Senator Johnson hasn't agreed at this point. So what's the idea behind that? Is this a campaign tactic, or is this really a good campaign finance kind of thing?
Well, you know, I think it's a bit of both, I would suggest. I mean, it was the deal that was made between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown in Massachusetts. The idea basically is to keep the campaign, keep the election within the state, and so that the money to support the buying of advertisement and campaigning in general is coming from inside the state, not from external national groups that are not connected to the state at all. And both, you know, there are assets and difficulties with regard to this kind of pledge for both the candidates. I said this in 2010 as well, that given some of the costs of running a Senate race, if Russ Feingold wasn't going to be willing to take, quote, outside funds, it was unlikely that he would be able to win a Senate election in the state of Wisconsin again. And in 2010, he lost.
And he's in a bit of a bind, and he's been, as you mentioned, taking heat, not just for his PAC, though, but for currently, it looks like more of his money so far has come from out of state than in Wisconsin, something he had said he wouldn't do in previous elections. He isn't living up to some of the ideals, his critics say, that he had established in previous elections. So is he hypocritical in a way if he doesn't live up to those old standards?
Well, you know, It certainly is a critique that can be made with regard to taking money from people who are outside the state of Wisconsin. At the same time, that if it's your campaign committee, you can send the money back, or you can try to get people inside the state of Wisconsin to give more money. It's a difficult conundrum in which you find yourself in terms of the sort of the outside groups and the way that campaign finance laws and rules work with regard to sort of external groups running their own ads. That's a different issue, and that's really what the pledge, the Badger pledge, is about. And Feingold first ran for Senate, I believe it was in 92, and said, he wanted to take more money from people who were in Wisconsin than outside of Wisconsin. And since that time, we've seen, of course, the Citizens United court case, which has changed the dynamics rather dramatically with regard to funding and spending in campaigns across the country.
Now, some people feel very passionately about these issues, about campaign finance, but for the voting populace as a whole, are they caring about all this back and forth on where the money comes from?
Well, it's sort of very complicated in terms of the laws and the regulations and a lot of that can get really deep into the so-called weeds. But at the same time, Russ Feingold has, made a lot in his political career with regard to trying to limit the money in politics, particularly in campaigns. And so while there's a lot of complication with regard to election law, for Feingold in particular, this is a little bit of a more tender vulnerability, if you want, with regard to how he operates his campaign and what it looks like, in part because he's made a name for himself by trying to sort of work against big money in politics.
We're talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, about the latest on Wisconsin's 2016 U.S. Senate race. Today, the National Journal listed the seat as the second most likely in the country to flip parties. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Campaign finance, as we've mentioned, has featured heavily so far in the race. Do you want to see the two candidates agree not to accept third-party support? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, about the latest news on Wisconsin's 2016 U.S. Senate race. Today, the National Journal said, hey, this is the second most likely seat in the country to change parties. Attacks from both sides have gotten off to an early start. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the rematch between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson? What guidelines do you think the candidates should follow for campaign fundraising and spending? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lily, in this race, I think back to our last Senate race, Tammy Baldwin, Tommy Thompson. Tommy Thompson, a popular figure. He won a lot of elections for governor by big margins. He came in with a fairly decent approval rating, I think, coming into that Senate race, and ultimately lost. Is that worrisome for Russ Feingold in kind of a similar position from the other side?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's a difficulty in regard to, trying to have a second career in politics, famously. It was said that nobody ever has a second career in politics, except then Richard Nixon had one of the most famous second careers in politics. But Tommy Thompson had also not run a campaign for an elected office for some time when he did come into the race against Tammy Baldwin. And I think that may be somewhat of a difference between Feingold, who ran in a race 6 years ago. Tommy Thompson had spent time in the W. Bush administration. He'd been, sort of out of the public domain for a little while, also in the private sector. And so you see a little bit of this going on right now with some of the folks who are running for president. And Jeb Bush hasn't run in a campaign for over a decade, I believe. And so some of it is, sort of getting the kinks out, getting used to the campaign trail again. And to some degree, Tommy Thompson hadn't run for for a statewide race in Wisconsin for some time before he ran in that Senate race in 2012. And so there are some similarities that should potentially give Feingold some pause, or at least, you know, make him pay some attention to some of the problems that Thompson faced. But it is a little bit of a different creature, I think, in this Senate race as well.
Go to our callers now. We've got George on the line in Green Bay. George, hi.
Hi. I appreciate the show. I just wanted to mention that Russ Feingold has certainly demonstrated a very important willingness to fund a campaign without the special interest groups. I'm very concerned about the current political system in our country. The millions and billions of dollars being pumped in by special interests can only obligate those that are benefiting from those funds, and obligate them in such a way that we have a dysfunctional Congress. We have people representing special interests, therefore not negotiating for us individuals. I think it really contributes a lot to our lack of confidence in our politicians. Our system appears broken if we don't rectify the funding sources.
George, thanks for the call. So that's an issue that I imagine Russ Feingold would try to run on. Do you think it would resonate with voters? Do you think he can make that case again, Lily Gorin?
Well, you know, I think that the issue of money in politics is a very complicated one, and it's one that does engage a lot of voters because they see people who are donating large sums of money. I mean, you heard this from Donald Trump last week at the Republican debate that, you know, he gave a bunch of money to Hillary Clinton when she was running for office, and she had to come to his wedding as a result of that. I mean, it's sort of it's not exactly how it usually works as well in terms of what do people want when they donate a lot of money to a political campaign. They don't usually want you to come to their wedding, I think. They usually want some policy outcome. But, you know, there is this question of what it is that big donors want, or big, you know, sort of super PACs want when they're donating to campaigns for Senate, for House, for presidential campaigns. It usually means access. And oftentimes it means that the candidate is willing to support policies that are, you know, that are pursued by these super PACs or big donors. And so that's where, you know, the regular voter who doesn't have a lot of money, like me and many of us who are probably listening to the show right now, our vote is not to some degree as valuable as somebody who can write a check for $1 million.
Back to our callers now with Anna in Madison. Anna, hi.
Hi. So I was just wondering your thoughts on whether if Senator Johnson does agree to, you know, not take the money from the third party, if that will actually benefit former Senator Feingold, like it seems like he thinks it will.
Oh, interesting. So he wouldn't have as much in his toolkit in a way, Lily.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the pledge is an interesting one, in part because, you know, Senator Johnson is fairly wealthy, and I believe he spent a pretty sizable amount of money of his own in the 2010 election, and so that the pledge wouldn't preclude that, him spending his own money, and Feingold has made some money on books and so forth, and consulting, and so, you know, the pledge is about sort of keeping other people who have super PACs and really deep checkbooks from contributing. And it probably would be something that both Johnson and Feingold would have to figure out how to work around in terms of the money coming into their campaign would be less.
And very briefly, Lily, given this might be a big race for control of Senate, it could be a lot of money coming in from around the country here.
Exactly. I mean, the National Journal article is pegging it as the top race or the second most, you know, sort of contentious race. Wisconsin has been a swing state in presidential years. So you're going to see money coming into the state through other areas as well. And the Senate race is one that would potentially decide who has the majority in the Senate, the Democrats or the Republicans. And so there's going to be a lot of money sloshing around in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there, Lily. Thanks for joining us. That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, talking about Wisconsin's 2016 Senate race.